Welcome to the VoxGig Developer Relations Podcast. I'm your host, Richard Roger. I speak to people in the software development community about developer relations, public speaking, and community events. I'm the CEO of VoxGig, a software consultancy that builds DevRel tools. Because we believe in the power of community, we host a monthly virtual online meetup for everyone in developer relations. Check out devrelmeetup.com. And visit voxgig.com to view our work, use our tools, and sign up for our newsletter. Okay. Please sit back and enjoy my fireside chat with today's guest. What happens if the tool that you're selling is a little bit hard to understand? How do you do developer relations then? In this episode, I talk to Sean Falconer of Skyflow, an API-based data privacy vault. We talk about the challenge of educating your user base and the way that podcasts can really help with that. Okay, let's talk to Sean. Sean, welcome to the VoxGig with Fireside podcast. It's great to have you on. It looks like a lovely sunny day for you. I'm seeing lots of sunlight streaming in the window. I'm looking at grey clouds here in Ireland. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's one of the benefits of being a Canadian expat to moving to California is that we have a lot of sun here. And when people complain about the rain, I'm like, oh, you have no idea. That is the luxury of someone who grew up in an area that has great weather. When you grow up in a place that doesn't, then your standards essentially for what a good day is much lower than those that grow up in great climates. But
100%. I spent a summer in LA before COVID, and our kids got invited to a birthday party in a public park. I was like, "Oh, are you sure about that? I mean, it could rain." I was like, "Oh, okay, no, it's not going to be a problem in LA. You can organize birthday parties and stuff is just going to happen, right?"
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, now that I have children, I really appreciate what my parents went through because they had three kids growing up in Canada and the amount of gear that you need to put on a child to get them out in the winter.
Yes.
And then you have to like change them completely. Now I can take my kids out 12 months of the year in pajamas and it's without shoes on and it's completely fine. And it's hard enough to get, you know, 2 and 4 year olds at the door. So I can't imagine having to like get the snow gear on top of that every single day. So I have a lot of empathy for what my parents went through.
But I would imagine that what your parents went through and what you go through with your children is nothing compared to herding the cats of developer relations at Skyflow, right? Tell us more about Skyflow and what you guys do.
Yeah, so Skyflow is a data privacy company. Essentially, we offer what's known as a data privacy vault as a service. And you know, one way to think about that is it's essentially the same way that you might use like an identity provider like Okta or something like that for creating a shared service for identity across your entire stack. Skyflow Data Privacy Vault can essentially be like a shared service for PII, secure PII or personally identifiable information management across your entire stack. So regardless of whether you're using third-party SaaS applications like a CRM or, you know, a marketing automation platform like a HubSpot or downstream services like Snowflake, Databricks, and so forth, essentially you can have one shared service across all those different applications to essentially manage your PII. It gives you isolation protection and governance over that. And it makes a lot of the challenges around data privacy, compliance, security much, much simpler. And it's all available through simple APIs, essentially.
Yeah. So I'm guessing, I mean, there's a lot of need for that in Europe, right? Because we have a whole bunch of regulation. But California is not far behind, I think, right?
I mean, we have the CCPA and Europe historically has always been sort of ahead of the game when it comes to regulation with GDPR. And then actually the AI EU Act just passed a couple weeks ago.
Yeah.
So they're really leading the charge there on AI. But a lot of other places are now sort of catching up. And there's over 100 privacy regulations in the world. And a lot of them were modeled after GDPR. Australia, India just passed DPDP last year, which is modeled after GDPR. More and more countries have data residency requirements, which essentially, for those that don't know what this is it's regulations that talk about like where essentially your customer data needs to live. So if you have a global company and let's say you have customers in Germany, then there could be there's a German regulation that says, hey, if you're going to store information about our citizens, we want that to live in a data center that runs within Germany. And then there's certain laws about like how you can transfer data in and out. And there's many, many countries now that have these. And these become really, really complicated as, you know, engineers or, you know, infrastructure teams, because suddenly you have to figure out like, how do I control where the data lives all over the world. And I could get into a situation where I'm running like multiple, you know, AWS cloud centers, like in, you know, 10 different countries. And it's hard enough to, you know, run one centralized cloud center, let alone like 10 different instances of the same thing.
So you guys manage that complexity, right?
It's kind of like, yes, exactly.
Right. So the way Stripe or Paddle, let's say, manage sales tax complexity, that type of thing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, we've definitely seen it in things like LLM applications where you kind of ask, you know, that prompt that you just generated there, where is that going? All that data, that sensitive data. How do you do that? So as a developer, okay, so let's get technical for a minute. As a developer, I'm trying to submit prompt to an LLM that's got PII in it. So how do you guys solve that problem?
Yeah, so if we take the LLM use case, so there, of course, there's like, I would say privacy and security is probably like, if not the top issue, it's like, you know, the first, second, or third, like biggest blocker to people like investing in those technologies, whether you're using something like ChatGPT or, you know, Copilot or something like that as a company, or you're looking to like actually build an LLM-powered application. Privacy, security of your customer data, your internal information, whatever it is probably like one of the biggest concerns. It's like a boardroom discussion at many, many companies. And the big problem there is that one, like versus a database, there's no like row and column to delete information within LLM. So once you've essentially used PII or employee information or whatever it is to train an LLM, then it's kind of there forever. It's like, you know, if I tell you delete what an apple is from your brain, like you're not going to be able to do that. And you can't tell an LLM to go delete information from the model because it just is not meant to do that. It's meant to learn, not unlearn. So that is kind of the big, that's a big challenge in the world of, you know, the right to be forgotten, or even when we're talking about data residency. How do I run a global LLM that's trained maybe on customer data that is also global and comply with these data residency requirements? Like, I'm not going to have 10 instances of my LLM running within each country or something like that. So what we can do and what customers do with Skyflow, with their Skyflow Vault, is we offer essentially like a gateway service where for training, let's say you're starting with a bunch of data. That data probably contains some level of sensitive data as well as non-sensitive data, and it's unstructured. You can essentially have that pass through your data privacy vault, where the vault can automatically detect sensitive customer data within the documents or audio files or whatever your training material is, and replace it with de-identified forms of that data. And then your training pipeline can continue as normal. And we can essentially identify the data and maintain context. So for like a training purposes, like if I have something like my name and my home address in the training materials, like the LLM doesn't actually care that it's my name and my home address there. It just needs a representation or stand-in for that data and have enough context to understand that that's a name and an address. So basically we can tag it as name and address and also give it a de-identified value. And do that consistently. So every time Sean Falconer is encountered in the text, it's going to get replaced with like name ABC123 or something like that. So then the
like a two-way lookup, right?
Exactly. So then, and then on back to inference. So if I put in a prompt and I say like, where was Sean Falconer born? Then the prompt's going to also go through your Skyflow vault. We will detect and de-identify Sean Falconer the same way. And then we give that the LLM to perform the inference step. And then when the response comes back, if there's de-identified values in the response, not only can we re-identify those, but we can re-identify those based on essentially the fine-grained access control policies that you put in place. That way, you get one version of that response, maybe I get a different version of response, or we can make it so that, you know, you aren't able to see certain information. Because like ultimately, when it comes to like security, like sure, we can run like a private LLM and put a fence around it. We build this like brick wall. But from like a privacy standpoint and a practicality of using it, essentially you need a brick wall where you can sometimes like punch a hole through it to allow certain information through, depending on who that user is. So you want your customer support person to be able to see certain types of data, but you want your CEO to see, you know, a different version of that data. And essentially, it's not just about de-identification, re-identification. It's really about like controlling who sees what, when, and where. And you can use that.
Yeah.
You can do all that stuff through essentially our platform.
Yeah. So it's like, The complex enterprise product, I mean, clear market need. One of the reasons I asked you on as a guest is because of all that stuff, the way that you guys do developer relations, the way that you interact with developers is really, really interesting, right? Because as you said, right, onboarding developers onto your system is ultimately sales-led motion, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like developers discover your APIs, play with them, and then recommend the system. It's, as you say, this is a boardroom level decision. Mm-hmm. It's an extremely high touch sale. It's an extremely high touch integration. The features and the integrations themselves are really complex. So what does that look like from a developer relations perspective? Right, you worked in developer relations in a number of different organizations, including very engineering focused ones. So just walk us through how you're doing developer relations in this context.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So, I mean, I think that regardless of whether, you know, it's a sales led versus, you know, a product led growth motion, or even like, you know, open source versus closed source engineering versus, you know, more of like a marketing spin and stuff like that, I still think I see developer relations as this like umbrella that encompasses like four different areas where you have developer marketing, developer education, developer success, and developer experience is sort of the binding ingredients between those four areas is like community. And I think the difference is like the tactics of each of those and the focus areas might change from company to company, and also depending on like who the core, you know, persona that you're trying to address is. So for us, like our core buyer persona is a CTO. So it is an engineer. It's just like an engineer that's leading an organization. So you have to, when it comes to thinking of through like content or how do I, you know, engage these types of people, you need to be thinking about it through probably the lens of an engineering leader versus necessarily like the application developer. I do think that there can be a bottoms up motion where you are focused more on like developer community builders and even something that eventually could be PLG. But for a company at our stage, we're 130 people or so, it's pretty hard to do two of those motions simultaneously and do them well. Like even if you look at like a company like Snowflake, they were sales led until like about a year or something like that before their IPO. And then the last like 3 or 4 years, they've done a really good job of sort of focusing more on the builder community and building that up. But they waited quite a while before they were, you know, they were hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue before they ever did that, because they probably didn't want to distract themselves from like what their core business model is. But in terms of the way I think about developer relations, though, for us is we have what I would call like a new category problem where people don't necessarily know what a data privacy vault is or what they need or like why they need it. So we have to educate the market for that. And that was part that was really attractive to me because I think it's very rare that you get to come to a company and be the first person to sort of like educate the world on a particular technology, especially a technology I think is so important to like helping protect essentially, you know, consumer privacy. And we've done a historically a really bad job at that when it comes to like, So I mean, just look
at the industry, right?
We were just search data breach in Google News any week and you'll see. So that was really exciting prospect to me to be able to do that. But I think like the key is to figure out like what are the things, like the problems that people are trying to solve now, what do they care about? And there's lots of ways of finding that out. You can do that essentially based on your own experience, maybe as an engineer or developer or what, or you know, building companies. Or you can also look around, like look at places like Stack Overflow, look at what conversations are being held. So, you know, one of the first places I started was Stack Overflow, and I saw people asking questions about like, how do I safely handle social security numbers? Or like, how do I handle credit card numbers in a way that's PCI compliant? Or how do I, you know, navigate data residency requirements while running, you know, one instance of Snowflake or something like that? So within any of these pockets of different technology, AWS, Snowflake, like even SaaS products like HubSpot, you can look in their forums and you can see people asking these types of questions that are relevant to our business. And then you can come up with essentially content strategies that map to helping them solve those problems. People like problems and solution and like solutions for that. And you can, it's not about ramming them over the head about like Skyflow, and you should use this technology, but you can talk about the problem. You can even show them from first principles, how would you solve this problem, like building that thing up, and then be like, hell, by the way, you could also just use this service if you don't want to have to build all that stuff from scratch because it's complicated and difficult. And, you know, if you want to do that, you know, here's a way to contact us or talk to us.
Where do you feel, Sean, that the market is? Is there still, I mean, there's got to be a lot of education left, right? I mean, you guys are barely started, surely.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that there's been a couple things that have happened that has really, I think, helped like increase the visibility of what we're doing. So like one of the things that happened in the first couple of months that I joined Skyflow was I wrote an article called like why every engineer needs to know or needs to use a data privacy vault. And I didn't talk about Skyflow. I just talked about the concept of a data privacy vault.
Oh, okay. And, pure DevRel play. Very good.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. I mean, there's other companies that have, you know, a lot of inspiration for Skyflow came out of companies like Netflix and Google and Apple. So there have been a bunch of like leading technology companies that have used this approach to solving their, you know, privacy and security challenges. So that was kind of the inspiration for some of the stuff that we did was like, how do we take like technology that came from these companies and, you know, bring it to the world as available as an API and service. So that article just talks about like, you know, why this concept makes sense, how it works within, you know, different types of use cases and stuff like that. And I published that article for a website called Software Engineering Daily, which I'm now a podcast host for. And then fast forward like 8 months or something like that, this IEEE article came out about the future of privacy engineering. And in that article, they talk about how the future of privacy engineering is not privacy by design, but it's privacy by engineering through this new architectural approach of a data privacy vault. And the whole article is about how the future of privacy engineering is to use essentially a data privacy vault as this core piece of infrastructure for isolating, protecting, and governing access to sensitive customer data. Just like you would have a warehouse, a database, API gateway, all these core pieces, a vault should be there as well. And the reference that they used in that article was a Software Engineering Daily article that I wrote, you know, 8 months prior or whatever it was. So that's kind of like the full circle thing of like, hey, let's just explain this concept to people, why it has meaning. And then without us like, you know, trying to necessarily orchestrate this, these were not people that we'd ever met before. They ended up writing this article for IEEE, which is a very respected publication. And and now we use that essentially within like all our pitch decks as a way to show like, hey, we, you know, there's, it's not just us telling you this, there's market momentum around this concept and leading companies are following this approach. And you can have that too, but you don't have to essentially assign 100 engineers to go build this thing for 3 years.
Yeah, because it's because we've been working on it.
Yeah.
Are the insurers looking for it? Are they starting to look for it? Because I think that isn't that the key, right? When the insurers are going, oh, you know, here's your cyber insurance or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that.
Yeah, like the firewall, it has to have the same status as a firewall, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think, I don't know on the insurer side, but I definitely think that we're hearing consistently like companies come to us because their board is coming to them and saying like, you know, what's the state of your privacy posture? Because part of it goes back to like, they might see their competitors in the news because of some massive data breach. And now the board is like, we don't want that to happen to our investment. What are you guys doing to protect, you know, what's going on with your customer data? So I think between regulations that are happening, between sort of more and more people being aware of the consequences to their business when a data breach happens, there's more and more pressure on companies to address these things and creating a lot of market momentum around this. And again, they're going to be looking for specific solutions, usually how do I, you know, keep sensitive, you know, PII out of Databricks or something like that. And usually that's sort of the entry point to start to have a conversation with us.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think you guys have product market fit yet? Or, I mean, that's a bit of a personal question for a company, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, it certainly feels, I could definitely say I've worked on other projects and with other clients that have similar challenges. It certainly feels it's very strongly in the air at the moment. Is there an official category? Like, do Forrester or Gartner have a name for you guys?
So we were in a Gartner Magic Quadrant a couple years ago, and they kind of lumped us into like a security, I forget the exact thing that it was called, but into like a security bucket there. But there isn't
that's
necessarily
super old, right. That's super
old. Yeah, yeah. So because we're not really like a cybersecurity product, I would say we see ourselves very different from that. And when we're talking to a business, and they're, you know, maybe they're even looking at other types of companies that could solve their problem, like the majority of them, I wouldn't lump into like a cybersecurity tool.
So are you in compliance then?
No, I mean, I think that we're primarily like a privacy platform, privacy product. But that encompasses, of course, all these other things around like data security, data residency, and so forth.
So does this drive, okay, that positioning and then the education bit, does that drive the tactics that you're using?
Yeah, absolutely.
Relations, right? So like, presumably you guys don't have like a Twitch account, right? Because that's not
no,
that
yeah,
feel I mean, aligned with this, right? Or maybe you
yeah, I mean, I think me. That like there's you know, I have friends that work in DevRel that have used Twitch and and these different mediums, or even TikTok and stuff like that. I think that's less of a fit for us because again, like we're trying to really get into engineering leadership, and it really comes down to like where are those people like hanging out, like what communities are they a part of? And a lot of times they're part of like LinkedIn is probably like a better network. They're also part of like maybe they're involved in Snowflake or Databricks or certain types of technologies like that, that are part of like anybody's like modern cloud. A lot of them come, they, you know, they're data people. We're data people as well. So there's lots of ways of sort of connecting there. But again, like it's less about the sort of younger, earlier engineer. They're probably not the person who's going to be one making the decision or even doing the implementation, because typically what ends up happening is, you need somebody who is sort of at the intersection of engineering or at least technical, as well as understands the business impact of like not doing anything. And then also has essentially the authority for change.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you basically need somebody that's in the intersection of that. And then it could be the CTO or VP of engineering or something like that, depending on the size of the organization. And they're generally going to be like, the person who comes in and says like, hey, this looks good, or they assign someone below them to say like, go and talk to these people, you know, vet the product, get into the details. And then that will be like a deeper level technical conversation usually. Sometimes they'll bring in their security counterparts, maybe someone from privacy or something like that. They're not necessarily the people who really have like carrying the checkbook, but they might come in to just make sure that things look good from a security and privacy perspective, and talk to our privacy and security people to make sure that we know what we're talking about and that we're experts and so forth. And then at some point the integration is going to start, but even then it's going to be fairly senior people, because depending on what kind of integration it is, it could be something that potentially touches a lot of areas of the company. There's lots of ways of starting. Like, it doesn't have to be complicated. Like, we have even GoodRx is, you know, a big customer of ours, and they did a migration from an existing product that they were using last summer, and they migrated like live migration without any downtime.
Awesome.
Nearly a billion records in like 3 weeks. So it does it, even something that it's, you know, probably one of the more complicated scenarios, it was able to come together very, very quickly.
That's awesome. Wow.
Yeah.
One of those tactics that I have to ask you about, because you are also a podcast host, is podcasting, right? And it it feels like podcasting fits into that space, right? Because it is going to be slightly more senior people who do have to drop their kids to school in the morning, who are going to be commuting, right? Even if they work from home, right? You still got to drive to school. Yes. So I have to ask, what possessed you? And this is the pot calling the kettle black, but what possessed you to start a podcast? How's it been going? And if somebody in the developer relations space has been tasked to start one for their company, what would you advise?
So what did you, I guess what like starting with the, so I host three podcasts, But the one I started with for Skyflow is called Partially Redacted, which is kind of focused on like privacy, security, engineering topics. And the reason I thought that it might make sense is going back to this like new category product, like a new category challenge. Like a lot of it's about educating the market and also making sure that we're seen as like thought leaders in the space so that you feel comfortable. You see like, oh, these people are experts. They know what they're talking about. And I thought like a podcast could be a really good medium for that, because a lot of times the audience is, you know, if you do it right, you can get essentially to that, you know, senior leadership level that is trying to, you know, commute to work while also passively listen to something they like, so that they are, you know, educating themselves about something at the same time. So that was kind of the original idea. And I felt like when I looked at what was available in that space for podcasts, a lot of them were really focused either on like sort of the legal side of privacy, whereas I didn't really want to focus on, I wanted to focus on engineering, and then or sort of cybersecurity rather than more being like, hey, as an engineer or someone who's building like a company, building infrastructure, like what are the like things I need to be aware of and think through? So that was kind of like where it started. And so I just committed
to it. There was a missing space.
Yeah, I felt like there was a missing space. And there's been it was an experiment, really. Like, it's like, you don't know 100% whether it's going to work or not. And I love podcasts. I'm a big podcast listener. So I felt like there was something there. And I think a lot of times, especially with a startup, you have to kind of, you know, take some leaps of faith sometime and trust your gut with stuff, because you're never going to have all the data. And really waiting for like too much data means you're probably, you're moving too slow. Like, you need to sometimes just take a leap of faith and see if it works out. So I just committed to it. And I was, you know, putting out podcasts. And I've been doing that now for, you know, well over a year and a half. And there's been I think a surprising amount of things that we've gotten from it, where like our CEO has been stopped at different events and stuff like that, where people run up to them and said like, hey, I love like, you know, Partially Redacted, I love that podcast.
Win. Awesome.
And there's been people we've generated customers from it. And I think you have to approach these things from like an honest, authentic place, just like any developer relations tactic. It's not about like selling something and being overly marketing and stuff. Just like help people solve problems. And if you do good work and you focus on those types of things, I think a lot of times like good things will come out of that. Like even, this is for Software Engineering Daily, one of the other podcasts I host, but I interviewed the field CTO of Health and Life Sciences, at Snowflake,
yeah,
a while ago. It was part of the biotech series that I was doing. Harini Gopakrishnan is her name. And it had nothing to do with our relationship with Snowflake. I just thought she was doing, I read some of her Medium articles about drug discovery with Snowflake, and I thought it was really interesting. And I reached out to her and we did this podcast. And then we do at Skyflow a lot of work with Snowflake. We're Snowflake partners. And then a couple months later, I'm on a call with a bunch of their ACLS team, and Harini's there. And she's like, oh, I didn't even know you worked for Skyflow.
Classic and then, developer relations moment.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
The payoff is 6 months later, but.
Yeah, exactly. And now we're co-authoring an article together about using Skyflow and Snowflake together for healthcare and life sciences use cases. And we're looking at doing some speaking things together. We co-host dinners and all this sort of stuff. But none of that, you know, like, I don't know that we would have had that same, built that same relationship and been able to fast forward that as quickly I hadn't just been doing her, you know, a favor and came to her like with an honest,
you were starting from a place of, this is actually something I want to talk about, right? This is no agenda.
Yeah, I was just naturally curious about her work.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Do you think we'll get replaced by AI chatbots talking to each other on podcasts?
I think we're quite a ways away from that. You know, I do think that, of course, generative AI is a hugely valuable tool that we should all be leveraging. And I think you're doing a disservice if you're not trying to leverage these tools. Just like, you know, when the first IDEs became a thing, it was much better than, you know, coding probably in Vim and Emacs to be able to move to using an IDE. or, you know, using things like term completion or code completion within an IDE, like, is hugely valuable. Templates, all these types of things really speed up our ability to write code. Copilot certainly is something that's hugely valuable, as well as when it comes to generating content and stuff. But I think we're a long way before, like, even stuff where, you know, if you just look, I did recently did a podcast episode on prompt injection attacks. And some of the things there, you know, where people say, like, you know, write a piece of code that can determine whether someone's a good or bad person. And it comes out with this, like, horribly racist, like, code, like, those things make me feel like we are still quite a few years away from these, you know, the any of this technology being in a place where we can, like, fully trust it. But at the same time, that being said, there's still a huge amount of value into it.
Oh, for sure. For sure. No, I'm always interested in the specifically how AI, LLMs, generative AI is going to affect developer relations, because content is such a big part of what we do. But I think the point that the interesting thing is that interaction that you just explained, that story, you know, where you were talking to someone and 6 months later something happened. You can't generate content that does that.
Yes, yeah, I also think
person to person interaction that made that work.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at, like, engineering and you ask this question of, like, is AI going to replace engineers? So, like, even if the AI is writing the code, I still don't think it replaces engineers. Like, what you're paid to do as an engineer is to solve problems. And solving problems doesn't necessarily have to do with you typing on a keyboard the right code. It could be actually, you know, executing some sort of sequence of steps that generates code to let you solve a problem. And I think for developer relations, similarly, like, people hire us for developer go-to-market strategy or solving problems and really, like, building relationships and building relationships at scale. And a content can be a piece of how you start to build relationships, but that is not, like, it's a little bit like, would you, like, can you replace essentially like, going on dates with somebody by having AI generated like chat interactions
well,
online?
I believe that's
I
a really
think
big
that's
market
gonna
as well.
Get you
yes. No, but it's you're right. Right, it's in the name. It's literally there. Right, developer relations. Right, mm-hmm. It is about the relationships,
and it's also internal and external relationships. I think sometimes we forget that too. Like, it's not just about the external. It's like, how do you bring it back to the company and deliver value to the company? Whether that's, like, influencing product, influencing engineering, you know, influencing whatever, in order to, like, help actually improve the entire experience for everybody.
Sean, that is just awesome. Lots to think about there. Congratulations on becoming head of marketing as well, right? So climbing the developer relations the career ladder. Although the interesting thing is that, yeah. So let's finish with one question, because a lot of people ask me about, you know, what do I do if I'm a developer advocate? Where do I go? Where does my career go? I've seen people leaving and going back into pure engineering. They didn't feel they had a career progression pathway. And I think you're kind of a little bit of a role model for, hey, you know, DevRel is actually a safe place to be, right? It doesn't harm your career. Was that a natural thing, you moving into that role? Or was that something you wanted to do? Or how did that happen?
No, I wouldn't say it was by design by any means. You know, Skyfoot was really technically the first time I'd ever worked within a marketing department. You know, when I worked in developer relations at Google, we were very much an engineering organization, and I was more like a product manager there than anything, or an engineer. Like, we owned all external facing tools, with SDKs, APIs, developer experience, and so forth. And then at Skyflow, that was originally some of my focus, but also it really came down to, like, looking at the what problems we needed to solve as a company. And because no one, you know, we didn't have the luxury of Google, being Google, where people know what Google is, and it's easy to, you know, get people get attention. We had to create attention. So then it ends up, you kind of lean more into the marketing side of developer relations naturally, if you're trying to just, like, fill gaps and solve problems. And that's really where I focused. And when I had, before I joined Google, I was a CTO and founder of a company. And that's really kind of where I learned sort of, like, marketing and go to market, product marketing, product positioning stuff, because I basically had to learn that stuff because there wasn't other people to do it. Like, I was forced to do those things. Like, yeah. I learned some of the business side of the business. Like, how do you build an SDR organization? Because if you don't figure those things out, you just die as a company. So those became forcing functions for me to learn some of that stuff. That's how I learned content marketing, SEO, these types of things. And those are valuable skills, even if I didn't end up sort of applying them down the road, just kind of know how to do those things. And that was how we were able to, like, you know, make that company really go. And when I joined Skyflow, I think just because there was existing gaps, and I think a lot of times, like, the fun part about joining a company at the stage where Series B, 100 people now, 130 people or so, it's like jumping into different problems and trying to solve these things, because it's all about, like, everybody's trying to drive to that win. And it's not about, oh, that's not my job, or this is my swim lane, this is your swim lane. It's like, how do we solve problems? And, like, how do we make customers, you know, happy? And it doesn't really matter. We're just going to, you know, jump in those. So there was essentially a gap, leadership gap to run marketing. And the CEO approached me and asked me if I was interested. And I stepped up and did that. And it's been really, it was not like a by design thing. I don't know that I'll, every job I've taken, I've done something like substantially different than the prior job. So who knows where I go from here, but I've really enjoyed sort of the challenge of like solving new problems and figuring this out. And I do think, you know, to other people who are thinking about their progression in developer relations, I do think that sort of the CMO role is going to start to look more like people with my background than maybe the traditional marketing leader, because there's so many developer tools. There's so many products now that are, you know, took open source projects and then created managed service out of them, and have to figure out, like, developer go to market, developer motions and stuff. And yeah. I think having somebody who really understands that world, that came from that world, is tremendously valuable with figuring out, like, how do we position this thing? What is the product message? How do we keep it authentic to the users and the communities that we care about?
Yeah, and you have credibility then with the audience as well, which is super important. Yeah, I think you're just proving again that if you're doing developer relations, you just have to be jack of all trades, right? It does suit generalists, right? Are you gonna Pokemon all the executive roles, right? What's left? CEO, COO, CFO, CFO.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe
you gotta do them all. Gotta catch them all.
Well, when I was leaving Google, the other roles I was looking at were more product leadership roles. So maybe I'll go there next. To be a CPO or something like that, or maybe I'll start a company again and do the CEO thing. So
there you go. World domination, of course. Yeah. Sure. Thank you so much. Super insightful conversation. Super insightful. Thank you. Take care. Bye bye.
All right. Thank you.
You can find the transcript of this podcast and any links mentioned on the podcast section of our website, voxgig.com/podcast. Subscribe to the VoxGig Developer Relations Podcast on Apple, Spotify, or any podcasting platform. We publish each Tuesday and Thursday. You can also access the archive of our meetup talks on the VoxGig YouTube channel or the VoxGig website. Thanks for listening. Catch you next time.